Hi, everybody. Marco Werman here. Before we get into the show, I've got some exciting news to share. The world is participating in Newsmatch. From now until the end of the year, every dollar donated to the world will be matched. This means that a gift of $50 will actually provide $100 of support to our work here at The World. If you have ever considered giving to The World, today is the day to take intention and turn it into action, one that we will be deeply grateful for. Every day, The World crosses borders and time zones to bring you stories that matter. As a nonprofit newsroom, we rely on contributions from listeners like you to keep our reporting free and accessible to all. With Newsmatch, you can double your impact. It takes a lot to keep the world spinning, and we cannot do it without you. Head to theworld.org/give to donate today. From everybody here at The World, thank you. One undocumented immigrant has long feared a knock on the door from ICE. Now, Inauguration Day can't come soon enough for him.
I've been staying in safe places, moving around, just staying low. It'll definitely be a day of relief.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, a hopeful story about a man who escaped the war in Syria. Now he's going to school to help fight for his country's future.
The more you know, the more dangerous you are for the dictatorship.
And human rights groups are asking the 2022 Olympics be moved out of China.
With all the evidence that they have at their fingertips, it's just utterly ludicrous that they believe this was the right move.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to have you with us today. While President Trump digs his heels in challenging election results, the declared winner is getting on with the business of planning his presidency, including how he'll tackle U.S. immigration policy.
On day one, I'm going to send a legislative immigration reform bill to Congress to provide a roadmap to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants.
That was candidate Joe Biden in June. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, joins me to look at what a President Joe Biden could have in the works. Monica, President Trump began his administration by limiting immigration in broad strokes. Remind us what was enacted under Trump and how Biden, when he becomes president, is expected to respond. What can he do or undo by executive order?
Well, right out of the gate, the expectation is that they'll bring forward legislation to Congress to try and push forward a path to citizenship for the estimated 11 million undocumented people in the United States. It's something that Obama tried to do, failed to do, and Biden will try again. It's going to be a huge challenge, a divided Congress and Senate. So the pressure will be intense to move fast, quickly, boldly. And we'll hear plenty of people like Jose Munoz, who is a leader with United We Dream, a national immigrant rights organization. People like Jose saying, Biden, you better deliver.
Young people, Latinx people, first-time voters, they came out in historic numbers to really, really help deliver a key victory for Joe Biden. They showed up. There is a mandate for our Biden administration to deliver bold, progressive change on some of these issues.
Right. And so people like Jose, many people who organized to bring out, especially, you know, people from the Latino community to vote for Biden, to back Biden, they're going to want to see those efforts rewarded.
What about the cap on refugee admission to the U.S., Monica? Like, the numbers were high under Obama, historic low, though, under Trump. Can Biden just change the cap on day one?
He can change the cap, and he will do so, he said, and that he will raise that cap to about 125,000. And that's something that, of course, can't happen overnight because resettlement agencies here in the United States, they had to lay off people, close up offices. It's going to take time to restore that program, but that's something that Biden pledges to do.
Also, there's a range of possibilities of what Biden will be able to achieve in his first days. What could happen between Biden's first day and, say, 100 days into his presidency?
What we'll see right out of the gate are the things that President Biden can do via executive action. So, for example, lifting the various travel bans, lifting the program that requires asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border to remain in Mexico while their court cases play out in the United States. That's something that he can unwind immediately. There are many things that he can do via presidential proclamation, executive order, including restoring the DACA program, which allows people who came to the United States as young children to have a work permit and not fear deportation as much. So there's a lot on the executive order front.
We talk, Monica, about immigration policy as a concept, but you've been speaking with undocumented immigrants themselves who have a lot at stake here. What are you hearing?
I'm hearing a lot of relief, especially from people who perhaps came here as young children or have been living in the United States for many years and perhaps are on the radar of immigration officials who can say, you know what, under Trump, you are eligible for deportation. One person I spoke with, Marco, and somebody I've been in touch with all year is this young man. His name's Julio, and he lives in Wisconsin. He's in his 20s, and we're only using his first name because in December, he got a DUI. And because he's undocumented, that puts him on the radar for immigration agents for deportation. You know, ICE could come to his door anytime, pick him up, and put him in detention center. I talked to him this week, and this is what he said. This is a little bit of our conversation.
I've been staying in safe places, moving around to stay low. So I'm definitely limited into what I can do.
You're laying low, and the inauguration might be a date of relief for you in some ways, perhaps?
Definitely be a day of relief. As much as I want to criticize Biden and Democrats, I am still somebody who, you know, has a left-leaning view of the world. So I appreciate that we're going to get a fascist out of the office, and we're going to have somebody who's going to actually listen to us, and hopefully he'll be able to push for these changes that he said he's going to do.
Wow. That speaks volumes. Inauguration Day, a day of relief. Monica, what can President Trump still do between now and the 20th of January?
He certainly can't do what he wanted to in a second term, but there's still plenty of under-the-radar tweaks and changes to the rules and regulation of the immigration system. There's going to be a lot of vigilance over the next few weeks over what the administration will want to try and accomplish on immigration, its signature issue, until the day it exits.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
European Union regulators are blowing the whistle on Amazon. They say the e-commerce giant is illegally boxing out the competition. The European Commission today filed antitrust charges against Amazon and accused it of using independent sellers' data to gain an unfair advantage over smaller retailers. Tommaso Valletti is a former European Commission economist who has been part of lawsuits and investigations that targeted the likes of Google, Facebook, and Amazon. Valletti says the latest EU lawsuit pursues two lines of investigation. The first focuses on the so-called buy box displayed prominently on Amazon's websites, that feature that shows you select products and makes purchases extra easy. Here's Valletti.
Amazon may put in the buy box products they're offering themselves, self-preferencing.
Mm.
And the other line is data. And there's lots of data that Amazon has, and these data are obtained from third-party sellers because they give all their sales data, the price data to Amazon. These data are not public, so other competitors, other companies could not see those. And the amazing computational machine that Amazon can use, they can put together this data, this information, and can do a lot of things. They can identify products in my profitable entry itself in ways that then are going to kill the competitors. And overall, consumers are not going to be better off in the longer run. And competitors might not even have known the extent to which such data would be utilized or extracted.
The buy box that you mentioned, that's also about data because the company tracks what the buyer is interested in, right?
Absolutely. But let me say at the outset that this is just an investigation which has started. So this is a formal step. But these are not yet accusations. They are not fines. So now the conversation between Amazon and the European Union will go on for many months to come.
But this is the beginning of a lawsuit. That's the headline, isn't it?
Absolutely correct.
So compare for us how the EU and the US are going after big tech. What are the differences in their approaches to challenging these big companies?
The US has been sleepy for 22 years. The last antitrust case in this tech sphere was Microsoft in 1998. Until now, we have US versus Google that was just announced 3 weeks ago. So to say the least, the US has not done much, has not done anything, in fact.
But the EU generally, as you suggest, has been more aggressive in their approach. But has that approach been effective?
I would say it hasn't. So one thing is to run cases, and another thing is to find good solutions. And the EU has not found good solutions, so they've been quite timid when it came to the possible remedies. The US has two lines of investigation now. One is applying the current law. That's the suit of the US Department of Justice, the DOJ. And the other one is the report that the Congress made also about a month ago, which is saying when problems are structural, the structure has to be changed. So we have to not be so timid when it comes to remedies. We have to think of solutions such as breaking up the technological giants.
So, for example, could the EU cut off markets, national markets, to Amazon if it wanted?
I don't think this would ever be envisaged. The European Union is more thinking about introducing ex-ante regulations. So like we did in telecommunications, we are saying companies that there are certain things they cannot do ex-ante, not just waiting after the fact exposed, including, for instance, the ability not to discriminate against anybody. So this is the self-referencing. In other cases, you can think of interoperability, interconnection, so that other players could have access to your data as well.
I know the EU has leveled pretty big fines against tech companies. What if the fines were larger? Would more pain make a difference?
They will never be large enough because Amazon, Google, Facebook are making hundreds of billions of dollars every year. And the fines, if you look at them, are in the range of $3, $4, $5 billion. An ordinary person, that's a lot of money, but given what they make every year, these are just peanuts.
So, Tommaso, is this case, is this lawsuit, is it about data, or does the EU see it as keeping monopoly in check?
This is about making sure that monopolies, who have grown big on their own merits, once they get the market power and dominance that they have, do not abuse market power. So we want to make sure that Amazon, which is a great company during the pandemic, they've done lots of great things, but they cannot just cement the dominant position to the detriment of everything which is around them, because that's the best for us, for citizens, for consumers overall.
Tommaso Valletti, professor of economics at Imperial College Business School in London. Thank you for being with us and explaining this.
My pleasure.
There are many places you cannot get to these days with a U.S. passport. Americans are banned from many countries because of the COVID-19 situation here. But if you have enough money, you could buy your way into European citizenship and a passport that opens doors.
There is an island in the Mediterranean where prosperity is a way of life.
The island nation of Cyprus made headlines this week after it reportedly gained a new citizen whose name you might know, Eric Schmidt. The former CEO of Google, according to the news website Recode, is now a Cypriot passport holder after he took advantage of a controversial citizenship by investment program in Cyprus.
Buying a property is the most easy way to obtain the passport.
Theo Andreou runs a so-called investment immigration firm in Cyprus. He says the process is fairly easy if you're loaded. You do need to have between 2 to 3 million euros, somewhere in the ballpark of $3 million, to invest in property, or you can transfer your business to Cyprus. The fat price tag does have its benefits. Cyprus is a member of the EU, so a Cypriot passport means easier travel to nations in the bloc. Also, visa waivers to 174 countries, and Andreou says there's more.
Our taxes are more lower than any other countries in Europe.
So tax haven possibilities. Andreou says his clients are usually from Russia, China, and Middle Eastern countries.
We didn't have such a big request from Americans before, but the last 6 months to 8 months, we saw a big tense of Americans asking and requiring and actually buying properties to obtain citizenship.
An increase, Andreou suspects, that is due to pandemic travel restrictions and domestic politics. Citizenship programs like these have helped financially struggling countries like Cyprus, but they're also controversial. Critics say they could be used by criminals to hide their assets or evade prosecution. In fact, this is precisely what happened in Cyprus, according to an investigation by Al Jazeera.
We show how a criminal with a golden passport could change his identity to evade justice.
Of course, this is Cyprus.
That Al Jazeera investigation is partly what led Cyprus to get rid of its investment citizenship program just a few weeks ago. Google CEO Eric Schmidt, though, did reportedly make the cutoff just before the program was scrapped. We reached out to a representative for Schmidt, but did not hear back. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Last year, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed won a Nobel Peace Prize for helping end a two-decade stalemate between his country and Eritrea. This week, he sent federal troops into a province of his own country. Hundreds are reported dead in the northern region of Tigray, and refugees are spilling over the border into Sudan. So what explains this shift from peace to conflict? Michelle Gavin is a former ambassador and senior fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ambassador Gavin, we're talking about the Ethiopian province of Tigray, where the violence is happening. It's squeezed into the northwest corner of Ethiopia. Tigray straddles the border of Eritrea to its north. What is so important about Tigray relative to the rest of Ethiopia?
Well, for many years, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, the sort of dominant political and military entity in Tigray, was really first among equals in the ruling coalition for all of Ethiopia. So Tigrayans played an incredibly prominent role in Ethiopian governance, politics, and security. But with the rise of the new prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, there's been a bit of a rebalancing in Ethiopia. And this has kind of opened up contestation from ethnicities across this incredibly diverse country. And there has been kind of widespread feeling that for too long, a small minority from Tigray had too much control of the federal government.
So there's political tension between Tigray and Addis Ababa. Are there also historical grievances between Tigray and the central government that we need to mention? I mean, is there a backstory here to why Tigray is now fighting Addis?
Oh, there's a lot of backstory in Ethiopia. And certainly Tigrayans were an incredibly, they weren't just dominant politically and in the security services for many years, certainly under the leadership of Prime Minister Meles, but they also suffered most in the long and very costly in blood and treasure war with Eritrea. So there's also a, you know, a sense of probably grievance in that since Abiy's come to power, they feel targeted by new personnel choices, by new policy choices, what maybe others in Ethiopia see as a rebalancing. The Tigrayans can often feel like persecution despite the tremendous sacrifices that they have made for the country.
There are reports from Tigray of an Ethiopian air campaign, heavy bombardment at times. I mean, what's at stake here as far as you can tell, Ambassador? Is it a possible civil war between Tigrayans and Ethiopian troops? Or is Tigray saying, we've had enough, we want independence? I mean, how should we interpret what's going on?
We should absolutely be worried about a civil war, which I don't think would necessarily be contained just to the Tigray region, given all of the other tensions and actors. So what's at stake? The well-being of over 110 million Ethiopians, regional stability. Conflict in Ethiopia has a very high chance of drawing in Eritrea, Sudan, and tipping the balance of Sudan's own very fragile transition. Ethiopia is an incredibly important actor in trying to bring stability to Somalia, to South Sudan. A distracted and weakened Ethiopia is really quite devastating to this entire Horn region, which is strategically really significant. And there are a lot of actors external to Africa, from the Gulf, the Chinese, and from the West, all of whom care deeply about stability in this region. So the prospect of drawing others in, of proxy conflict, it's really a powder keg. And the consequence will not be confined solely to what's happening inside Ethiopia's borders.
Michelle Gavin, Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She also served as ambassador to Botswana from 2011 to 14. Ambassador Gavin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Protesters are back in the streets of the Peruvian capital, Lima, today. Also today in Peru, just this morning, a new president got sworn in after Peru's Congress removed former president Martin Vizcarra over corruption allegations. For more on this, we have the world's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia on the line. It seems to be a busy news day in Lima, Jorge. First of all, why the protests?
Well, Marco, it's because it seems very few people are happy that President Martin Vizcarra was removed from office. In fact, the legislative body in the country is very unpopular. And President Martin Vizcarra, who is being accused of corruption, people are very upset. They're out on the streets with pots and pans. If you look at the images, it is a flood of people in downtown historic Lima today.
We'll get to the impeachment drama in a moment, but first tell us about the new president of Peru. Who is he?
Yes, his name is Manuel Merino. He is a businessman and a politician, of course, from northern Peru. He is a member of the center-right Acción Popular, Popular Action Party. And today he is best known as the man who spearheaded the two efforts to remove Martín Vizcarra from office just in the last few months.
And as to the impeachment of Martín Vizcarra as president, how and why was he removed from office?
The hearing yesterday was over an investigation over still unproven allegations that he received about $630,000 in bribes when he was governor of a region in southern Peru. That was 6 years ago.
And Peru's Congress has the ability to remove a president over an ongoing investigation?
The Constitution doesn't require Congress to have full confirmation of wrongdoing. So I was a little bit confused by this, to be honest with you. So I called Alonso Cárdenas. He's a political analyst in Lima.
The terms of this removal are not very clear because President Vizcarra was accused of several cases of corruption, but these cases were under investigation. So we don't know if he's guilty or not.
Marco, the other piece of context to know here about what the law allows Congress to do is it allows Congress to remove a president if they believe that he is, and this is a direct quote of what it says, a permanent moral incapacity. If Congress believes, if enough members of Congress believe that the president has this nebulous permanent moral incapacity, they can remove him from office. So now Manuel Merino, who took office today, he is now the third president that Peru has had since 2016. In fact, there's a long list of Peruvian presidents over the last quarter century that are either in jail because of corruption or they're being investigated.
So, Jorge, how does this presidential turmoil in Peru now affect the country's ability to respond to the pandemic?
No matter how you look at it, it is terribly destabilizing. In fact, I wanted to get a doctor's perspective on this because this is a healthcare issue. So I called Edward Málaga Trillo. He is a neurobiologist at Universidad Peruana Cayetano Heredia. And actually, when I reached him, he was at the protests.
Hey, Jorge, the protests taking place all over downtown Lima, somewhere between the Congress building and St. Martin Square. There's lots of people marching, and actually the numbers are growing.
Dr. Málaga Trillo says that what he's concerned about, and many people are concerned about, is that the incoming administration of Manuel Merino has given no indication that they have any plans or any idea of what they're going to do about the public health issue that is the pandemic in Peru. As always, with a transition of power, there's going to be a new cabinet, very likely a new health minister. And this is really just exacerbating the situation for Peru because Peru was already in a very vulnerable position.
The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia with an update on the latest on the impeachment of Peru's president, Martín Vizcarra. Jorge, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Here's a reminder. The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. We report stories from around the globe with nuance, context, and by listening to voices of people most affected by the news. Do your part today to help us keep access to The World free. And right now, when you donate, your contribution will be doubled. The World is participating in Newsmatch, a campaign to raise money for high-quality, independent journalism. To donate, go to theworld.org/give or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. On the coast of British Columbia, sea wolves are a rare sight.
You know, people think, oh God, how can you just sit there and not see anything for 83 of those 90 days? But you can't feel sorry for somebody who's sitting on a big white sand beach waiting for wolves to come out.
Our conversation with renowned wildlife photographer Paul Nicklin is just ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Tomorrow morning, the International Olympic Committee will meet virtually. The first topic on the agenda is not the Tokyo 2020 Games, which have been delayed until next year. It's the Winter Olympics in Beijing in 2022. There's talk among politicians and the human rights community of a boycott. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Countries around the world are talking about the 2022 Winter Olympics, but they're not counting down the days until the games begin in Beijing. They're considering a boycott due to alleged human rights abuses across China.
An estimated 1 million Chinese Muslims have vanished into a vast network of detention centers for what China calls re-education.
Among those weighing the boycott is Britain's Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab.
The concerns of what's happening to the Uyghurs is something that we cannot just turn away from. Let's consider in the round what further action we need to take.
Plus, Florida Senator Rick Scott.
The 22 Olympics shouldn't be there. We got to say, China, until you become a legitimate country that is going to respect human rights, we're going to quit doing business with you.
And Australian Senator Rex Patrick.
And in fact, we shouldn't have our own athletes standing up, lending their good names to a regime that has conducted itself in the manner that it has.
International human rights organizations are making similar demands. In September, more than 160 of them wrote a letter to the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, asking for the games to be moved out of China.
We have been attempting to have a dialogue with the IOC for many, many years.
Mandy McKeown signed the letter. She's the campaign's coordinator for the International Tibet Network.
We have been campaigning to urge the IOC to change its attitude to China since 2001, since they first awarded the 2008 Olympic Games. So this is nothing new.
What is new is that this time the IOC agreed to meet with the organizations. They gathered virtually in early October. It was a welcomed opportunity, but one that McKeown says didn't lead to any promises of a change in venue.
With all the evidence that they have at their fingertips, it's just utterly ludicrous that they believe this was the right move.
The IOC thinks it's the right move because they believe in the separation between sport and politics, which the executive director, Christophe Dubé, reiterated at a recent press conference.
The games are about sport and about the athletes. And this is a line we do not cross.
China agrees. In September, the country's foreign ministry spokesperson, Wang Wenbin, criticized the human rights groups for their activism. He said some organizations have linked the so-called human rights issues with the Beijing Winter Olympics in an attempt to put pressure on the Chinese side, which is a mistake to politicize the sports movement. The thing is, a lot of people argue the exact opposite.
The intersection of sports and geopolitics has been a long-established fait accompli.
Lindsay Sarah Krasnoff is a historian and research associate with the Center for International Studies and Diplomacy at SOAS, University of London. She says one of the earliest examples of this nexus was the 1936 Olympics in Berlin.
When Nazi Germany served as host and really tried to use their host duties of the Olympiad to showcase to the world what they perceived to be the positives of Nazi ideology and how it had helped German society.
In other words, propaganda. There was some talk about boycotts, but when the games began, countries showed up. Only a few individual Jewish athletes from around the world chose to stay home. And Adolf Hitler presided over the opening ceremony. As thousands gave the Nazi salute and a flag with a swastika waved proudly through the air. Later, in 1976, nearly 30 countries boycotted the games in Montreal when the IOC refused to ban New Zealand, whose rugby team had toured South Africa during apartheid. Then came the only US-led boycott in Olympic history. The United States refused to attend the 1980 Summer Games in Moscow as retribution for the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Dick Pound was a new IOC member at the time and remembers questioning the U.S. strategy.
If you don't get out of Afghanistan, we're going to punish our athletes, and that'll teach you. And everybody's just shaking their head saying, well, this does not have the impact that you seek at all.
He's right. It didn't. The Soviet Union stayed in Afghanistan and instead organized a counter-boycott of the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. Pound says a Beijing boycott in 2022 could see similar results.
If your objective is to change Chinese policy, it has no chance of working. Anybody who thinks it has a possibility of working is just way off the mark.
What boycotts can do is serve as an effective PR campaign by forcing greater public consideration of the issues and pressuring governments into action. But with over a year until the 2022 Games, the reality of any country withdrawing is still up in the air. Alan Berner, a professor of sport and social theory at Loughborough University in the UK, says an Olympic boycott could lead to unintended consequences.
If there was a serious attempt to damage China's reputation through a boycott of the Winter Olympics, Xi Jinping would simply say, we had 100 years of humiliation at the hands of the British, the Americans, the Japanese and others, and they're doing it all over again.
Berner says that response could embolden China's president, not budge his policies. Dick Pound of the IOC says if countries go forward with a boycott, the athletes' Olympic dreams will be protected.
We will invite them ourselves as if they were refugees and leave it to the athletes to decide.
Activist Mandy McKeown says she and other human rights groups are still strategizing about whether to call for a boycott. One option they're considering is to send athletes to the games, but not heads of state. Here's what she's confident about. The Winter Olympics are slated to begin in Beijing in February of 2022. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
On the Pacific Coast beaches of Canada's British Columbia, there are packs of seawolves that roam the coastline, eating fish and seafood. This is what their pups sound like. The wolves had been threatened by hunters until conservation groups stepped in. Wildlife photographer Paul Nicklin and his group Sea Legacy helped raise nearly $500,000 to help save the wolves. Paul, what's distinctive and different about seawolves from, say, a regular wolf?
I mean, you notice as soon as you see them that they are an evolutionary distinct species. They are small. They're very slender. They have a very different lifestyle, very different culture than the big timber wolves that are taking down, you know, moose and deer. And these animals are out on these outer islands. They're swimming sometimes 5 miles offshore to be able to access a sea otter or a seal. They forage the beaches. They eat limpets and chitons and abalone and they eat salmon when the salmon return in the fall. So it's like finding a completely different animal.
Wow, they're swimmers.
They swim from island to island. You sometimes can be out boating miles offshore and you see something swimming. At first you think it's a seal, but no, it's a sea wolf that's swimming out to an island to go try and find a seal.
Wow. So why were they threatened?
These wolves that live on these small outer islands, for any hunter or trapper, it's a very easy home range area to target for these wolves. If you go sit on a beach long enough, a wolf's going to come out and you're going to be able to shoot it.
You teamed up with another organization, Rain Coast Conservation Foundation, and together you raised $650,000 Canadian, that's about $500,000 US, to save the wolves. What was that money actually used for?
The money was used to buy up the hunting tenure. So you have these huge tracts of land where people buy hunting rights, and Rain Coast has been raising funds for a long time to buy up this hunting tenure, and we were just able to inject that last bit of energy to push everybody over the line. A lot of people stepped up, and we were able to buy it.
It must have felt pretty good when you realized you had raised the money you needed.
Yeah, it feels amazing to be able to have the support that we do, to see the support that Rain Coast has. You know, you just sort of see one loss after another. So it just feels really great to be able to be part of a victory and just to have the support of, you know, millions of people who are excited to get involved. We've got thousands of emails of people writing us saying, we're going to get involved in this. We're donating. We've donated. You know, we're expecting it to take weeks, but within 48 hours, the funding was in place.
What's been the reaction from hunters or hunting groups?
Well, you know, I've had pushback in the past, and on this one, there's been none for me personally. I mean, maybe because of this interview, it might change that. But, you know, I welcome it. I welcome the discussion. A lot of hunters I know are good people. I mean, but they never have that emotional connection that you have as a photographer or a filmmaker. A hunter will see a wolf from 200, 300, 400 yards away when they shoot it. But when you're a photographer, you'll see that initially at 200 yards and then 100 yards and 50 yards, 10 yards. And all of a sudden, for me, in this case, with these wolves, it was the female, the alpha female, who kept watching us from afar. And finally, she came and sat and laid down in front of my blind, 10 feet away from me. She let out a little noise, and then all of a sudden, the whole pack is out in front of you. She called out all the puppies. There were six pups in the pack. All the alpha male, everybody came out, and they started howling. Like, she just accepted you. And, you know, I think if a hunter had that experience, they'd have a really hard time, you know, pulling a trigger on these animals as well.
Well, you stepped up to help save the sea wolves, Paul. What role do wildlife photographers have in helping connect people to animals they might never see for themselves in order to protect them?
The biggest thing we do with Sea Legacy is we connect people to ocean conservation. Very few people will get to experience the oceans. So almost in the way that Jacques Cousteau did, it's our job to bring the oceans to everyone, to show these sort of undersized, small animals that are playing and rolling around and romping and chasing and surviving off the sea. I think it just sort of injects your heart with a whole bunch of emotion. And, you know, we love the things that we can see. And, you know, that's the only way that we're going to get to protect them is if we fall in love with them.
You were saying, Paul, that on one photo shoot, you spent 90 days in the wild only to see seawolves on 7 of those 90 days. So you got to be patient. What's it like out there in that time? And what's it like when you finally see a seawolf?
You're in a meditative state when you're, you know, people think, oh, God, how can you sit out there, you know, and just sit there and not see anything for 83 of those 90 days. But really, you're surrounded by ravens, you're watching black bears, and you're seeing grizzly bears, and you're seeing orcas swim by. You can't feel sorry for somebody who's sitting on a big white sand beach waiting for wolves to come out. It really is a dream job. When you spend that amount of time sitting out there, all your other senses start to open up, your sense of smell, your eyesight, your hearing, and you essentially yourself, you become kind of wild yourself because you're just sitting there in silence, thinking and watching and listening for day after day. So for me, it's incredibly rewarding. And when that finally happens, you sort of have to pinch yourself when you've been sitting there for 2 weeks and you haven't seen anything. All of a sudden, there's a pack of, you know, 16 wolves in front of you, and they're howling and running and playing up and down the beach because they've decided to accept you. And all of a sudden, they're back in the forest again. And you're like, did that happen? That just happened. That's just really incredible. So it's a very powerful experience.
To see Paul's striking photos of British Columbia seawolves, go to our website. That's theworld.org, or our Instagram. We're at PRI The World. Paul Nicklin is a photographer and co-founder of Sea Legacy, speaking with us about the remarkable seawolves of British Columbia. Paul, thank you very much.
I really appreciate you having me on, and thanks so much.
The United States announced new economic sanctions against Syria this week, another reminder that the war there is not over. Since 2011, more than 5 million Syrians have fled their home country. Some 400,000 people have died. Today, though, we have a story of hope. It's about a young man who survived the brutal prisons of the Syrian government and eventually made his way to Europe. He recently found out he was accepted to a top university here in the U.S. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
This is the sound of a happy man. That's 25-year-old Omar Al-Shogri, who at the time he got the news was driving with his best friend, Todd, in the mountains of Norway.
And I said to Todd, we have to stop the car. I have to scream. I have to enjoy the moment. I have to call people. I just to go stop the car.
Al-Shogri spent the next 20 minutes debating who he should call first, his own mom, or maybe his Swedish mother, the woman who adopted him when he moved to Sweden as a refugee. It was a tough decision.
So I called my mom, told her, Mom, I will tell you something, but you don't tell anybody else because I want to have the joy of telling them. And I told her I was accepted to Georgetown. She started crying. And 1 hour later, the entire world knew about that. My mom told everybody, and every person mom told, she says to them, don't tell Omar that I told you.
Omar Al-Shogri has come a long way since leaving Syria. He was 15 years old when the Arab Spring swept through the Middle East. Syria witnessed one of the biggest uprisings in its history. People took to the streets to bring down the president, Bashar al-Assad. Omar and his cousins joined in.
I went to demonstration. I didn't think about the consequences of joining a demonstration in Syria. I didn't know that the regime will kill people, arrest people, torture people for just asking for freedom.
At first, the demonstrations felt kind of like a party, people banging drums and chanting slogans. But then things got ugly. Security forces started gunning people down in the streets, and protest leaders started to disappear.
And I was arrested. I was kept in prison, was tortured, I've been released, and I've been detained again. And released and detained again.
Al-Shogri remembers horrific details about his time at the notorious Branch 215 prison outside of Damascus. He was tortured, his fingernails pulled out. He was surrounded by dead bodies, he says. Later, he was transferred to another prison, nicknamed the Slaughterhouse. By the time Al-Shoghri's mom scraped together enough money to get him out, Al-Shoghri says he was a shadow of his former self.
Really skinny, really tired, really sick, and had tuberculosis.
His mom had fled to Turkey, and she paid a smuggler to get him out of Syria. But he knew he had to get to Sweden for medical care. So, like many thousands of migrants leaving Turkey for Europe, he began the journey in a rubber boat.
Come to Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, Austria, Germany, Denmark, Sweden. Going through 10 countries to get treatment for a sickness that is killing me. That wasn't easy.
Al-Shoghri made it to Sweden. There, he started a new life. A Swedish family adopted him and his brother. He started school. He also made it his mission to draw attention to the crimes committed by the Syrian government. He spoke at schools. He told his story at conferences and gatherings. He gave testimonies to European war crimes investigators and to the U.S. Congress.
Thank you, members of this committee, for inviting me to testify. As I'm talking to you right now, people are scared.
Testimony from witnesses like Al-Shoghri helped push the U.S. government to impose sanctions on Syria. European courts are using testimonies to prosecute former prison officials and torturers. But Al-Shoghri's work is not done. When he recently applied to Georgetown, he had one goal in mind, he says, to get quality education.
The more you know, the more dangerous you are for the dictatorship.
Al-Shoghri will move to D.C. in January. He says he plans to study business and international relations. He also wants to continue to raise awareness about people who have disappeared in Syrian prisons. He's hopeful that one day he can return to Syria and rebuild. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
After 6 weeks of fighting and thousands of deaths, there's a peace agreement in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia and Azerbaijan have both claimed the territory since the fall of the Soviet Union. The most recent armed conflict broke out there early last month. Neighboring Turkey and Russia both had a hand in the new peace deal, which was announced last night. Reporter Andrew Connolly has been following this story closely and joins us from Yerevan, the Armenian capital. Andrew, first of all, describe what happened last night. How did we learn about this peace settlement?
There had been persistent rumors swirling over the weekend that some kind of Russian brokered deal had been struck by the leaders of Azerbaijan and Armenia. But it was about just before 2 in the morning on Tuesday here in Yerevan when the Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan posted on Facebook that he had agreed to end the war after 6 weeks of immense military losses and military gains by Azerbaijan. And he described it as an unspeakably painful decision. But barely half an hour after he had posted it, the streets in the center of the capital filled up. Mobs of men broke down the doors to government buildings, trashing the place. They beat up the Speaker of the Parliament. An hour later, Mr. Pashinyan appeared on a Facebook live broadcast, said the protests were being driven by criminal oligarchs and his political enemies. And many Armenians do agree with those sentiments, but you can't overstate the shock. Vast swathes of territory is gone. People are questioning whether the thousands of soldiers, many of them boys barely in their 20s, died for nothing.
So the official rhetoric aside, clearly a lot of Armenians are not happy with the deal. Why are they angry with this particular deal?
Under the deal, Armenians would leave in a matter of weeks all seven of the regions surrounding Nagorno-Karabakh that Armenia has controlled since the 90s. Azerbaijan would also get to keep the gains that it's already made in Nagorno-Karabakh, some tens of villages, and crucially, the culturally sacred city of Shushi. The rest of the rump state of Nagorno-Karabakh will now, for now, remain under ethnic Armenian control and remain connected to the Armenian mainland by a 5-kilometer-wide stretch of land called the Lachin Corridor. And this corridor, as well as the front line up in Nagorno-Karabakh, will be monitored by Russian peacekeepers for a period of around 5 years, and a force of around 2,000 of those peacekeepers are actually already assembling on the ground as we speak. So it's a really bitter loss for Armenia. But as Prime Minister Pashinyan, also the de facto president of Nagorno-Karabakh as well, have both admitted it was either agree to this or risk more fighting, yet more loss of life. And Armenia has said, I mean, its military leaders have said that COVID-19 was also a significant drain on troop activity too. Mm. But essentially, it never had much of a military chance. Azerbaijan, what it failed to win at the negotiating table for the last 30 years, has just taken by force.
Since the start of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict last month, the U.S. and Europe have largely stayed out of it. Why is that? And do you think their involvement would have made a difference in this outcome?
The U.S. and Europe have always been quite peripheral to the conflict. The first war ended in 1994 as a result of a Russian-brokered ceasefire. And since then, the mediation has been conducted under the auspices of the OSCE Minsk Group. The three co-chairs are Russia, France, and the U.S. It is only a mediating body, though, so without real political will by Armenia and Azerbaijan to carve out a meaningful plan, it was kind of a toothless organization. Russia, meanwhile, has a dual role as both referee and arms dealer. It sells weapons to both sides. It keeps a small military presence in Armenia. Never took a strong side or position on the whole affair, which has also allowed Turkey belatedly to step in and lend a much bigger hand to its ally Azerbaijan. It's really the two regional powers of Turkey and Russia that are the key influences here. But over the years, there have been attempts by American and French and European diplomats to get the warring parties to agree to things. But in general, this region isn't massively important to their national interests. Mm. And this year, with the world consumed by COVID-19 and the U.S. elections, it mattered even less.
Reporter Andrew Connolly in Yerevan, Armenia. Thank you very much.
No worries. Good to talk to you, Marco. Take care.
COVID-19 has killed more than 1.2 million people around the world so far. Unimaginable a year ago. Still is today. One of those deaths was the longtime Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat. He died today at the age of 65 in a Jerusalem hospital. Starting in the 1990s, he had the task of finding common ground with Israel in an effort to broker a peace deal. He became a familiar voice on American news shows, including our own. Here is Erekat in 2001 on CNN, advocating for the two-state solution.
This is the only way to save the lives of Israelis and Palestinians. Please, let us stop scoring points. Let us stop finger-pointing. Let us go to sanity, wisdom, and courage, and come back to the negotiating table immediately.
Erekat was born in Jerusalem and educated in the U.S. and the U.K. He was a member of the Fatah political party and close to its longtime leader, Yasser Arafat. Erekat served as a top aide to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and a senior negotiator in sporadic peace efforts into the 2000s. He was considered a hardliner at first, but eventually he gained the respect of his rivals across the negotiating table. The former Israeli foreign minister Zippy Livni says she spent a lot of time with Erekat.
We have hundreds of hours of working together trying to achieve peace to our peoples. We didn't succeed in doing so, but yet both of us believe that it is our destiny in a way.
Livni said that Erekat recently messaged her after he got sick with COVID.
Just before he died, he texted me a message saying, "I didn't finish what I was born to do."
Saeb Erekat was a key figure in the Oslo peace process at a time when an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict seemed like an achievable goal. But as the years passed and negotiations stalled, hope turned into skepticism for many Palestinians and Israelis. Still, Saeb Erekat never gave up on the idea of a two-state solution. Just this past February, he maintained that as a goal.
My option is two states. I may be in the minority. I'm being criticized heavily by sticking to the two-state solution. But I know that if we want to have a solution, we must have a negotiated solution between us and the Israelis. And if we don't help ourselves as Israelis and Palestinians, that means this will be translated in the blood of my children and their children.
The Palestinian Authority says it's seeing a steady increase in new COVID-19 cases. More than 4,300 new cases were reported last week. WHO officials told us today that the virus is spreading fastest in the impoverished Gaza Strip, home to 1.8 million Palestinians. Many healthcare workers there are being infected with the virus and struggling to cope with the outbreak. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, and on social media, join the conversation about stories that keep you thinking and share them. Twitter is where you can find our team of journalists. We are at The World. I'm Marco Werman. Stay strong, be safe, and we will see you back here tomorrow.